To show how American industry is on the forefront of war, to show how they are really paying attention to things, Boeing Corporation announces that it is going to triple Patriot Interceptor production. Only 4 years in, I mean, why wait till the last minute, I guess? But that does indicate that where their mind is and where things may be going as we get close to what, by all accounts, is close to the end game of this war, one wonders what may be coming next. And in fact, we also have more dysfunction and more disabilities, probably is the right word, from European and Ukraine leaders on where this war is going. And to try and at least give us a shot at helping to understand what in the world is going on with the American and European and Ukraine folks in this war. We have back with us Colonel Doug McGregor, defense and foreign policy analyst, former advisor to Secretary of Defense, and highly decorated combat veteran. Doug, welcome back. Glad you're here.
Hey, happy to be with you.
Let's talk about that first issue first, because that kind of seems a little out of place that, you know, now then all of a sudden this announcement has come up that on the fourth year of war, Boeing has said they have plans to triple Patriot Interceptor deliveries amid rising demand, so they say. And when you take a look at what at least was reported yesterday, Gary, if you could put that other full screen up there, the company has they want to triple the production of Seekers, and that they have constructed a new 40,000 square foot facility to boost output. What do you make of the fact that this is coming so late in the war, and why do you think it didn't come earlier?
I think you have to go back and look at some of the initial assumptions about the Russians. Remember, these assumptions have not changed dramatically, sadly, but inside the Beltway, as you know, the attitude is, well, Russia's weak. Russia is not going to withstand the pressure of all of our sanctions and the influx of all this high-tech military equipment from the West into Ukraine. Of course, that was always nonsense. Russian society is not fragile on the verge of disintegration, and President Putin is not about to be removed. Quite the contrary. He's probably in a stronger position today than he's been since he took office. So I think that's part of the problem. The second part is that, keep in mind, this is not new technology. We're peddling old technology with the Raytheon Patriot systems. Have they made minor modifications to achieve modest improvements? Probably. But this is old technology, and experience with the Patriot to this point in time suggests that it's not that effective a system, especially when you're dealing with somebody like the Russians that can overwhelm you with numbers of missiles and so forth. So then what are we really talking about? I think we're talking about a concerted effort to transfer cash to the defense industry and to the donors and the shareholders, who in turn are also going to reward the people on the Hill that have shoveled cash in their direction. So this is, again, another exercise in transferring cash in a highly financialized economy. We're not building anything new. We're building more of the same.
That's a really good point, because Russia has continued to have additional advancements in its technology for its hypersonics, for its glide bombs, and a number of other, and they've continued to advance even throughout the course of this war. Interesting, you may recall, and I guess it was about the first year of the war, the Biden administration said that we're going to accelerate and you're going to have additional contracts that would take some time to produce, but they went from somewhere around, at least what was publicly reported, 500 Patriots produced per year to about 650 or so per year. Now, if this is a tripling of that, we may wonder if they're talking about tripling the 600, so maybe 1,800 a year. But given how many missiles and long-range drones the Russians are firing at Ukraine, how effective is, even if it's 1,800 and all 1,800 go to Ukraine, is that going to be against the air war that Russia is fighting?
Well, let's assume that any of these ultimately reach Ukraine anytime soon. I mean, the lag time.
We seem to have locked up there. I'm sure we'll have Doug back here in just a second. Picture seems to have frozen there. One of the big issues with the technology that we've had with the Patriots, you may recall Secretary of State Rubio last week admitted that oftentimes when we put these, even the new Patriot systems in there, they last about a week before they get taken out. So wonders. And I think that's a great point that Doug brought up there, is about the fact that you're just making old technology. And if these things are that ineffective that they can be knocked out that quickly, then the question has to be, what is having a bunch of extra ones going to do? If you're going to have, you can knock them out, it's going to take 3 weeks to knock them out instead of 1 week, because you're going to have triple the number. But, you know, there's the issues just with the interceptor missiles and the platforms to fire them from, because when the Russians are taking these Patriot systems out, they're taking out the whole system. They're not just taking out, the interceptor missiles themselves. And I'm sorry here. I got to hold on just a second. I got Doug calling in. Yes. Okay, I'll keep on just going on with the show, and as soon as you can get it resolved, I guess just jump back in. Sure. Okay, will do. Hopefully you can work it out. Okay. Got it. Let me get with Gary, because he may be able to do something that can help you out in a separate way. I'll get right to him. Okay. Bye. Gary, if you could, Doug's having some mechanical problem on the other end there. Maybe if you can go in with the phone and help him figure out, even if we could just get him on the phone, that might help. He's having a trouble getting connected back.
Got it. Okay. Yeah.
Work with him. I'll keep on going with this though.
Deal. That's a deal. You got it.
Yeah. And so, sorry about that. We have some technical difficulties. We will get Doug, I'm sure, one way or the other back with Gary on the show here. He'll get it figured out there. So there's a lot of issues with the interceptors. That's not going to solve anything. That's not going to change even the dynamics in the air war. Ukraine is having a deficiency that it can never overcome, because Russia has both the technical and the numerical superiority in the air war with their glide bombs, with their multiple categories of missiles, and then now the additional categories of even long-range drones, which are now, some of them are engine-powered, the Garand-3s, for example. You're never going to overcome that in the scale of this war. No matter what we do, we can't overcome it, especially if our technology, as Doug pointed out, is actually the same stuff that they already figured out how to bypass primarily. And even if you get more of it, and who knows when that would actually be produced, because this article didn't say anything about when it would be done, when they would be able to produce them, etc. All we know is that the numbers that are there now are insufficient. And thank goodness, here is Doug back.
Yeah, I heard that the advantages of living in the Blue Ridge Mountains.
That is nice. Yeah. So the issue being, you pointed out, you know, this is old technology. We're just making more of it, but Russia's advancing their technology. So what impact is this going to have on the war? I mean, just even the air war, what about the war itself? Will it make any difference?
No, I don't think it's going to make any difference at all. And again, when do these missiles show up in volume? No time soon. And I'd be surprised if this thing called Ukraine, led by Zelensky and friends, makes it through the holidays. If they make it through the holidays, I don't think they'll last much longer than January or February. You know, all this government in Zelensky exists for two reasons. On the one hand, you have Putin and the government in Moscow that does not yet want to completely eliminate the government, because they'd like someone to talk to put an end to this catastrophe. They may have someone in the wings ready to go in and take over. That's a possibility. But again, from the very beginning, one of the guiding imperatives of this operation was to avoid war with the United States and NATO. And that means, you know, don't do anything that could inadvertently precipitate a conflict between Russia, NATO, and the United States. That's been frustrating because it's resulted in a much slower pace operationally. And the second thing is that President Putin has made it clear that he's not sacrificing any Russian lives unnecessarily. And right now, the Ukrainians continue to accommodate the Russians by attacking them. And they have no effective air and missile defense. Their logistics is in disarray, if it exists at all. They've lost all the strong points that they formerly had. It's much easier for the Russians to pull up, contain the situation, ring it, encircle it, whatever you want to call it, and then annihilate it with strike systems, rocket artillery, conventional artillery, glide bombs, all of these things. So that is just progressing as is. Now, on the other side of the equation, you have the West. And the West has nothing that they can use to intervene in this war that's going to make any difference to Ukraine. But you have all the globalists in Washington, as well as in Paris, London, Berlin, other major capitals. They cannot give up. If they give up and say, yeah, you know, we lost this a long time ago. We've sacrificed at least 1.8 million Ukrainian soldiers and probably at least that many wounded or more. So we probably ought to throw in the towel. No, because their entire existence is dependent upon hostility with Russia. That's the sine qua non for the globalists. They don't want their populations to finally say, that's it, we've had it with this. Russia's not a threat. The threat to us is inside our countries. That threat is defined by you and all the migrants that you've admitted to our country that we cannot afford. You know, all you have to do is look through the BBC, look through the French channels. The Germans have a much tighter control. They don't allow anybody to really say very much. But everybody is frustrated with the amounts of money that are being poured into all of these migrants, while at the same time, they've got an unemployment problem. You know, in Great Britain, people have been out in the streets, hundreds of thousands demonstrating, saying, wait a minute, you're putting all of these migrants up in hotels. They're enjoying the high life. They have no shortage of cash. We're having trouble putting food on the table. You know, we can't do anything. In other words, they feel betrayed. And if you suddenly admit this whole thing is a hoax, this is a new Russia hoax, the Russia presents no threat, well, then what are you doing in office anymore? We want action. I think President Putin understands this. I think that also explains to some extent his own restraint, because he sees these governments falling sooner rather than later. And when they fall, everything changes. What are you going to get after Merz? What are you going to get after Macron? What are you going to get after Starmer? You're going to get people who are far more nationalistic. They are all going to be Britain first, France first, Germany first. In fact, in Germany, you're going to get Germany only. We're sick of the whole thing. And then there are going to be tough times inside these countries. And the same globalists that tried to drag everybody into war with Russia unsuccessfully, they're going to attack their own people for defending their countries against the migrants they don't want. I mean, this is where we're headed. We're going to see convulsive change in the West. It's going to happen here, too. It's going to take longer to get here, but it's going to happen everywhere in the West. The West is going to turn inward.
And you know, to your point there about the current leadership in the West who want to avoid that outcome, but also are unwilling to acknowledge reality, they're continuing to spread this information that Russia's coming west, and holy cow, we have to keep this going. This was in I think it was The Economist, the British newspaper Economist, where they're talking about that all these provocations are coming in from Russia to the edge. It says how they're blowing up tankers in Europe to drone sightings in Belgium, how Putin is pushing NATO to a cliff. Interesting the way they characterize this. This is from the article. Russia has long been accused of interfering in European affairs, but the issue was thrust back into focus in September when nearly two dozen drones crossed over into Poland amid a large-scale Russian drone attack into Ukraine. Days later, jets violated Estonia's airspace as Russia concluded major drills in Belarus. Subsequent activity near the border has forced Europeans to close airports and borders, causing major disruptions and exposing vulnerability. This was actually quite a long article, and they went on many things that say that there's been some railroad sabotage going on that the Poles claim on that are Russian. All kinds of things happened, some in Germany, some factories that have been blown up, and strange fires, et cetera. And look, Doug, I don't know the reality of how much Russia is doing some of this, but it makes sense that they would to me, because what is absent from this article or any of the discussions is the fact that Europe is sending billions of dollars to help Ukraine kill Russians. They're sending long-range missiles and drones into Russia to hit their oil infrastructure. They're having economic warfare on Russia. What do they think is going to happen in response?
Well, two things. First of all, keep in mind that most of the money is stolen. There's a reason that Zelensky has over $1 billion in his bank accounts. Remember, two members of his government and inner circle, Mindich, and I've forgotten the other one's name, they have now fled to Israel. because you cannot be, as a Jew, extradited from Israel, brought anywhere and placed on trial. I'm sure Zelensky may well decide to do the same thing, given the fact that he's also Jewish. These people are running Ukraine, and they're destroying it. They're running it into the ground. So you can give them all the money you want, and at least 50% of it will just vanish. It'll vanish into various black markets and into people's bank accounts. The Ukrainian army is no less corrupt than the rest of the society. We could spend hours talking about the corruption in Ukraine. So anything you send there is going to be wasted and stolen. The second part of this, though, is very important. Most of those claims that have been made have been debunked. They're just not accurate. They're wrong. I mean, when you pick up drones that appear to have been originally Ukrainian or Russian, and then repurpose them with microchips that are inserted from Poland, then fly them into Poland and try to create the illusion that Poland is under attack, it's pretty obvious what's happening. The Russians don't need to blow anything up in Eastern Europe right now. It doesn't make any damn difference what they do in Eastern Europe. I mean, if you're going to go after something, why not go after Rheinmetall, which is one of the largest defense contractors in the world? But Rheinmetall is not going to produce anything in any great numbers soon enough to make any difference to what happens in Ukraine. And thus far, everything the Germans have sent over there, the Russians have managed to destroy. Now, some of that is because the Ukrainians don't know what they're doing. But then again, some of it is also because those things have been employed inaccurately and ineffectively. We have just failed in the West to really study what has happened in Ukraine militarily. We think we have. We point to this, that, and the next. The Army just announced that they're going to pay for some outrageous number of unmanned aerial systems. In fact, you and I talked about that.
Yeah.
And your point was valid. Your point was, by the time this stuff reaches any future battlefield, it'll probably be obsolete, because that's how long it takes to produce these things. And the pace with which improvements are imparted to all of these unmanned systems is absolutely incredible. So we're out of it. And none of this matters. That just take that thing and throw that in the trash. It's irrelevant. It's another last gasp to produce some evidence that they can hold up to somebody and say, see, the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming.
You know, it's interesting. You talk about things that aren't going to make any difference. We're talking about the drones that we're doing here and what's also happening in Europe. I don't know if you saw Julian Ripka had an ex post, I think it was on the 15th, where he said, listen, y'all are all just fooling yourselves. He actually called it out from the West. He said, especially the Ukrainian general staff, the Ukrainian government, and the European governments are all focused on the wrong thing. They're ignoring the fact that Ukraine is going to lose strategically. He said it's already too late because you haven't done the things that might have made a difference. He said instead you've been focusing on things that don't make a difference. And it was right on cue after that came out that we had French President Emmanuel Macron come in and talk about something else that won't make any difference, and that is 100 fighters, which, by the way, will take 10 years to actually get all on site there. What do you make of this? And is this just the same thing as the Patriots that we're talking about, which won't even get there in any kind of order long before it'll or after it would make any difference on the battlefield?
Let's put it this way. In early March, late February 1943, Stalingrad fell on the 2nd of February. 4 weeks later, Hitler flies to his Eastern Front headquarters, not far from a place called Poltava, which has interesting historic meaning because that's where the Swedes were destroyed in 1709 by the Russians. Now, the reason I'm bringing this up is there was a meeting there, and he brought all the four-star equivalents in the German army on the Eastern Front into this room, along with large numbers of three stars. And Albert Speer had sat down with Milch, who was the chief of the Air Force, and Guderian, who at the time was the Inspector General of Armored Forces, and they put together a presentation. The presentation is very straightforward. The presentation says, we have limited resources and limited time. Think about that. Limited resources, limited time. We need to stop producing all of these things. He went down the line. Stop producing these V2 rockets. It's never going to come to fruition soon enough to make any difference to the outcome of the war. Sound familiar? Stop producing these giant assault guns, 152-millimeter assault guns that the artillery loves. Forget it. It's a waste of money. We need to do basically three to four things. Number one, put all of our resources, all of our money into jet fighters. Hello? Does that make sense? Sure. Build jet fighters. Nobody can match us. They already had heat-seeking missiles for the damn things. You name it, they had it. So that's where we need to go, number one. Number two, we need to stop building all these different tank models. Okay, we pick one tank model, and that's what we build. Then we build the assault gun. This was the 75-millimeter long-barreled assault gun. It was, you've seen it. There's no turret on it. It's sort of a fixed gun. Well, they managed to destroy 30, 40,000 tanks with that gun on the Eastern Front. He said, that's what we do. And then we'll have transport for the infantry. They've got to be mobile. You know, we'll use half tracks and various things. But that's it. That's all we build. That's where we put our force, you know, all of our resources. And Hitler said, well, generals, what do you think? And they all objected because they all had a dog in somebody else's fight. Oh, you can't take that away from us. Oh, that we don't want that. And we don't want this and so forth. So then Hitler, being the politician he was, turns to Guderian and Milius sitting there and says, see, how can I do what you want me to do when my generals won't agree with you? So the rest is history. Now, you take somebody like Michael Howard or any number of distinguished historians have pointed to that meeting and said, if you'd done things differently then, right then, the war could have gone on for three or four more years. That's how important the decision-making was. There has never been a coherent military strategy for Ukraine. Never. Remember, you started this and you started to talk about, well, look what's happened over time. All these years have passed. The Europeans say this, we say this, we'll send patriots. There's no strategy. In the absence of a strategy, you know, it's the old story. If you don't know where you're going, any road will take you to your destination. Well, that's what's happened in Ukraine. The destination has been reached. It's called total destruction. It's over. And the longer this lasts, the only outcome will be more dead Ukrainians, more destruction of whatever the infrastructure is that's left, whether it's the energy grid, electrical grid, doesn't matter. Everything will be destroyed and there will be nothing left. Now, perhaps that's Zelensky's secret goal. I don't know. But my point is, it's over. It's been over for some time. You know, draw the right conclusions and end this thing. But for the reasons we're discussing, the globalists cannot give it up. And remember, their populations aren't dying. So the hope is that the globalists can precipitate or provoke or evoke a response from the Russians that will kill some of their citizens. And their hope is then everyone will get mad and do something. I mean, it reminds me of Churchill during the Second World War in late 1940. The German Air Force, whether it was deliberate or not, I don't remember, but they actually struck the shipyards in Glasgow, Scotland. And Churchill celebrated. This is wonderful. We'll finally get the Scots on board for the war, because people in Scotland didn't want to go to war. Certainly not against Germany. They did that once before, and it killed hundreds of thousands of their people. So they weren't interested in doing it again. That's where the globalists are right now. They would like the Russians to do something that can then become a catalyst in their minds for real resistance and real wartime thinking in their own countries against Russia. It's not going to happen.
And you know, that's further bolstered by, first of all, what Gary was showing you just a second ago. I actually thought at first that video was an AI, because, you know, look how he's grinning there, how happy they are and smiling. I thought it was one of those fake videos, which we've seen some. Turns out, no, it's quite true. And then when Macron went to the microphones subsequent to that, he wanted to talk about, you know, where this was going. And just tell me if this has any relationship to reality nearing the 4-year mark of this war.
Russia has independently chosen the path of war. Nothing justified the war. No real threat, only fakes. Through a complete disregard for the truth, with reflexes and instincts characteristic of a state that cannot come to terms with its own history, imperialist and neo-colonial instincts. Today, only Russia has decided to continue this war and even intensify it. You have been constantly demonstrating your real readiness to enter into a truce since May, and all that can be said, all the efforts of recent months, everything is ready to move towards this truce. Only Russia continues the war.
I mean, that's about as Orwellian as you can get, that only Russia wants to continue the war. They had no justification. And this poor little Volodymyr Zelensky next to him, he's the only one that wants to end it. What do you make of that?
Well, there's one other point that needs to be made. The other thing, in addition to the arguments and the rhetoric, which we can characterize as fake, we can also point to the money that he's talking about, which is also fake. And that is the final straw that will break the camel's back. We are in a fight right now in the United States with the help of our European allies to defend to the bitter end the dollar's reserve currency status, because that's how the billionaires became billionaires. We live in financialized economies. It's true for Europe. It's true here. We don't produce much of anything. So how do we make money? It's called transaction fees. It's called financial instruments. And that's how most of your billionaires who currently are shaping policy here in the United States have made their money. They are going to fight tooth and nail to keep that reserve dollar status, but it's failing. It's failing very, very badly because no one wants it. The dollar is something that people don't want to have to do business in any longer. And so incrementally, each passing week, each passing month, as we move from year to year, fewer and fewer people are doing business in dollars. The Saudis, who we think of as strategic partners, are now doing business with China exclusively in yuan. And the yuan is now establishing its connectivity to gold. And gold is going to become the standard for BRICS. We're in a lot of trouble. So we're on a very short tether, if you will. We can't go on much longer than we have thus far. And I think that's also behind all the ridiculous statements and rhetoric by Macron. And by the way, in France, I think his approval rating is probably almost as bad as Donald Trump's. I think Donald Trump is hovering around 30%. And I suspect that's where Macron is. I'm sure that's where Starmer is. And Merz is not far behind. All of these people are on the road to extinction as political leaders. There's no question about it.
As it turns out, not everybody in Europe is this delusional. And in fact, everybody in Europe didn't used to be, even among some of these major powers, didn't used to be. There was an interesting interview with Viktor Orban a couple of days ago where he, first of all, was kind of lamenting about some of his relationships with previous versions of leaders. You've talked about Chancellor Merz a lot. Well, he was talking about Angela Merkel. And he's first of all started off and said, we had a lot of disagreements. One was over the Green New Deal, their version of it. Another was over immigration, which you pointed out a minute ago. He said, we are 100% apart on that. He said, but the thing that I did value about her is that she would sit down and listen and consider options, and they would actually act rationally. And then he added this.
Strategically, what is the interest of Euro? What is the relation to Russia? I almost 100% agreed with her. There was moments at the European Council when she was the only one and me who argued on the same platform for peace and cooperation. So I think I follow what's going on in Germany. So I'm not a stupid guy. I know what's going on. And now it's quite fashionable to say bad things on her. It's not fair. It's not fair. She did good things for Germany and good things for Europe, and of course some bad things as well. So to be correct or fair is important in politics. And on the Russian issue, she was right.
So what do you think about? Was Angela Merkel right?
Well, Angela Merkel did do some things well. There's no question about it. But I probably would be harder on Merkel than Prime Minister Orban. Orban is telling the truth, at least insofar as Merkel was there when in Bucharest when they had the meeting in 2008 and pointed to the expansion of NATO and trying to bring Ukraine in as a serious mistake. She said trying to bring Georgia and Ukraine in to NATO is going to provoke Russia. Well, everybody that knew anything about Russia, knew anything about Eastern Europe, was well aware that that would happen. I mean, we heard that from George Kennan back in the 1990s. That's not news. It's just that people chose to ignore it. Even Kissinger, who is about as duplicitous as anybody who's ever lived, made that comment, and he was correct on that occasion. So I think he's making some good points, but the point is that she was also the architect of Germany's destruction because of not just the Green New Deal, but the mass migration, invasion of Germany. And all you have to do is look at Germany's cities now, the places where they're ensconced, these vast numbers of people, the enormous cost to the German taxpayer, the dramatic rise in criminality, little boys being raped and murdered and so forth. And these things are not even allowed to be reported in the press anymore. She deserves the lion's share of credit for pushing that. And again, she's another co-conspirator with von der Leyen. Von der Leyen was the defense minister, and she was a disaster. She was the one that was insisting that armored fighting vehicles be developed and built to accommodate pregnant women in uniform going into battle. I mean, I can't conceive of anything dumber and more stupid than that. But that was von der Leyen, and that was blessed by Merkel, and von der Leyen is now running the European Union. Now, I don't think she's going to last much longer because I think everybody's had it up to here, with the European Union. Here's what needs to be understood. Before everything ends, well, let's put it this way. This war in Ukraine is lost, and that's going to become patently obvious. And the Russians are going to be victorious. They're going to dictate the terms under which the map is redrawn and new actors emerge. But there's something even more important than what happens in Ukraine. And I predict that Germany will walk out of NATO and walk out of the EU because it's the only way for Germany to liberate itself from the oppressive influence and power of the EU and NATO. Remember, many of your guests have said this, and people always chuckle over it. I always thought it was deeply offensive and thought it was dead wrong. But this was the attitude in Great Britain and France and the United States, and that is NATO exists to keep the Russians out and the Germans down. Well, the Germans are finally emerging from this state of Stockholm syndrome that they've been living in for decades, where the German walks in the room and his head is bowed and says, oh, "I'm sorry, we're bad, and we know we're bad. And how much money do you want?" That's over. The Germans have had it with that. The new generation that's coming up is sick of it. The alternative for Germany is sick of it. And this Atlantic alliance has not produced security for Germany. It's dragged Germany into a confrontation with Russia that most Germans want nothing to do with. So Germany is going to march out of the EU. It's going to march out of NATO. When that happens, that's the end of NATO and the EU, because the only way they can exist is with Germany as the linchpin, as the keystone in the edifice. Once the Germans say enough and walk, it's over. And that's where we're headed. So this entire war in Ukraine that was launched to destroy Russia and was always linked to the idea, and this goes back to the White House in 2020 when I was in there and I wrote a paper on it and it was given to the president and he just, I don't think he could even imagine it, but it was an argument against disrupting relations with Germany because of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. And I tried to outline the hundreds of years of very profitable and productive relations between Russia and the German-speaking peoples based on an exchange of commodities, commercial relationships. And the elites actually got along very well. If you go back over the last 300 or 400 years of history involving Germany and Russia, the two world wars are anomalies. They should never have happened. And they did happen. It's tragic that they did. But I think both Germans and Russians have concluded this must not happen again. And Germany will leave the Atlantic Alliance, and it will leave the EU for these very reasons. And all the neocons that have done everything they possibly could to promote death and destruction and war in Eastern Europe and across the continent, these are the same people who have pushed these migrations, heavily funded by people like Soros and others, who couldn't wait to shove millions and millions of people into Europe who are not Europeans, will never be Europeans, cannot become Europeans, and don't want to be Europeans. they are all going to stand around and then begin to say, see, the Germans are evil. They're back at it again. They're evil because they're charting their own course. They've decided on their own future. It's a lot of nonsense. There's no Nazi revival there, nor will there ever be one, in my judgment. But what you see out in eastern Ukraine, for some reason, these same neocons are happy to see these Ukrainian soldiers sport SS emblems right. in their war with Russia, which makes no sense at all. None.
Yeah, that is something that didn't get much. It did get a little bit of press, but the significance seemed to be lost on people, I guess, because they're like, no, I can't acknowledge that, because then that would mean we can't support Zelensky because he seems so okay with it. But I tell you, one person that's not okay with it, and going back to that interview with Viktor Orban, he was also asked specifically about what chances does the Ukraine army, with the SS or not, what chance do they have?
European politics intellectually is very sophisticated, but what they are saying basically means that they would not like to have a peace just now. They would like to continue the war. They think, and they speak about it publicly, that we have to continue the war to support Ukraine more. The situation will improve on the front line, and we will have a better circumstances or preconditions for negotiation. Wrong, totally wrong. Not to speak about geopolitics and human dimension, economically and financially is just crazy. We finance a country which has no chance to win the war, but at the same time, there's a high level of corruption.
Yeah, now obviously that issue with corruption has exploded since he made those comments. You mentioned at the outset, one of Zelensky's right-hand men has been caught and is now somewhere in hiding.
He's in Israel, along with another one. They both fled to Israel. They will be safe there.
For now. If Zelensky falls, it's unclear how long they're going to protect him.
Oh, listen, I think they're going to be safe. Remember the gentleman who is a pedophile who was caught out in Las Vegas? I can't remember his name now, but it turns out he was an Israeli citizen. And he was flown immediately to Israel, where he has stayed and is safe and will never be extradited. No, I think the Jewish state will remain a haven for Jews, regardless of what they do anywhere else in the world. And that's certainly true for the two gentlemen that whose names escape me. One, I think, is Mindich or something.
Yeah, Mindich, yeah.
And the other one, I can't remember his name. But, you know, at some point, Zelensky will probably pack it in and go there as well.
Well, yeah, because I was going to say, and I'm talking to some folks who are on the ground in Kiev or have access there, and they're saying he is literally at risk. This could knock him out when nothing else do it. So apparently he's not as safe as many in the West may think, even with all these announcements.
Well, a lot of people have waited for him to be subjected to the Mussolini treatment. That may yet come. Who knows? He is distant from his own population. What no one here in the West is told, and you can only hear this from people who are on the ground over there or Poland or in Russia. I there are some Germans that will tell you this. I think one of them is named Baba. This is a German journalist. I listened to him and he said the same thing. The population has turned decisively against this war with Russia. They know this has to end before there's anything left. That's where they're headed right now. And the other thing is that Ukrainians living in the western part of Ukraine are also coming around to understanding that whether we like it or not, that government that emerges after this war in Kiev must be friendly to Russia. If it isn't, the Russians will march all the way to where we are, right up to the border with Poland, if necessary, to secure their country. We have never recognized Russia's legitimate national security interests in Poland, or Ukraine.
Ukraine.
Never done it. And we don't seem to understand, as a result, we, more than anybody else, are responsible for this bloodletting. You know, if there was a humanitarian bone in Donald Trump's body, on the basis of what's happened thus far, he would lower the boom and say, Mr. Zelensky, you're finished. You're out. However, I suspect that the same billionaires that are calling the shots in Washington in terms of policy towards the Middle East and towards Iran are also calling the shots in Ukraine. And these billionaires have decided that they want Zelensky there and they want to continue doing whatever they can to harm Russia. That's their agenda. That's not an American agenda.
Yeah.
That's what the billionaires want. And I think more and more people are coming around to understanding the billionaires really are in charge. You know, they own the House, they own the Senate, they own the White House.
I mean, it's hard to argue that when you see the fundamentals and the facts on the ground. Apparently, they don't own Viktor Orban or Robert Fico out of Slovakia, and that's why they say what is evident on the ground when many of these others don't. Listen, in the last few minutes, you mentioned President Trump. The amount of time we have left, I want to look at a couple of other things that are really going on in our own hemisphere. And while we're trying to get this Russia-Ukraine war to an end and trying to avoid any other ones, President Trump has given some pretty odd statements, I'll just say, regarding both Mexico and Venezuela at the same time. And you can also add Colombia in that are not helpful to American national security, I think. Here's what Trump said when asked about the potential for active military action inside Mexico.
Also potentially launching strikes in Mexico or putting American troops or American personnel into Mexico to deal with
drugs. Would I launch strikes in Mexico to stop drugs? It's okay with me. Whatever we have to do to stop drugs, Mexico is... Look, I looked at Mexico City over the weekend. There's some big problems over there. If we had to, would we do there what we've done to the waterways? You know, there's almost no drugs coming in through our waterways anymore. Isn't it down like 85%?
It is, sir.
I've been speaking to Mexico. They know how I stand. We're losing hundreds of thousands of people to drugs. So now we've stopped the waterways. But we know every route. We know every route. We know the addresses of every drug lord. We know their address. We know their front door. We know everything about every one of them. They're killing our people. That's like a war. Would I do it? I'd be proud to. I'd probably go into Congress and say, hey, and you know what? The Democrats and the Republicans would both agree, unless they're crazy. But we have lost hundreds of thousands of people a year. Death. And that's not talking about family destruction. That's talking about death. And much of it comes through Mexico. So let me just put it this way. I am not happy with Mexico, okay?
Okay, first of all, just a couple of factual issues there. When he says the waterways have been 85% cut off, that's nonsense. That number one, all these boats that we've been hitting are areas where they don't even have the range to get to the United States. And then the other thing he said there about, you know, all of these drugs coming in, that's where it's at. Well, listen, a vast majority, and I mean a vast majority of the drugs come in are through the port systems, and like 80% are through American citizens, not through Venezuelan people or drug boats, whatever. That's a minuscule fraction, and not even Venezuela. They're way down on the list anyway, but even through Mexico, et cetera. So his facts are just flat out wrong, and yet he's talking about maybe going into Mexico because he knows where all the front doors are, so to speak. What do you think of that?
Well, I did some work, I guess this would have been 14 years ago, down at Joint Interagency Task Force South, headquartered in Key West. It's a very good organization. At least the last time I was there, I thought they were doing a great job. And you had the integration of the United States Coast Guard, the Customs, drug enforcement, and even the Navy. And the biggest threat that they were dealing with at that point were these semi-submersibles. Semi-submersible is like it's not quite a submarine, but you have a very small tower on top of what looks like a submarine that protrudes through the water so that you get almost no radar signature. In other words, if you're trying to track it, it's so low and most of the thing is submerged beneath the surface that you can't really track it very effectively. And most of these came out of Colombia on the Pacific side. The reason, and sometimes they would come out on the Caribbean side, but the Caribbean side, you have essentially a continental shelf that runs along the Mexican coast. It's about 60 feet deep. So it's very shallow, which has its benefits. But the Pacific, instead of hugging the coast up to California and then delivering the drugs, as you point out, in places like San Diego, San Francisco, Long Beach, Los Angeles, they would move out to sea on an azimuth. And then at, once they were off the coast, sort of 30 miles, 40 miles, 50 miles, whatever it was in the Pacific, they would be met by tenders. In other words, vessels that would then resupply them with whatever they needed in terms of fuel or water or food. And then they would move towards the coast to their destinations in the harbors or the shorelines, estuaries. That continues. Now, how much, I don't know. I'm out of touch with it right now. But they were doing a fine job of tracking this. And it was, in one occasion, they not only tracked this particular semi-submersible from the air, and the Coast Guard had it, they actually had a United States Navy nuclear attack submarine that literally came up right behind the semi-submersible.
That'll get your attention.
Because they could track them very, very well. Now, the reason that was important is that most of these things, when they realize they're about to be captured or that they could be, they scuttle it. And they have safety gear that they put on, and they jump into the water and try to scuttle it. We like to catch those vessels, because what you find is that they have brilliant technology in terms of GPS and navigation equipment and surveillance equipment and so forth. This is a high-tech investment in a way to deliver drugs. So you're right, Dan. He's saying that. That's not really true. I wish it were, but it isn't. The Coast Guard is grossly underfunded. I've always been a big advocate for the Coast Guard. I would like to see the Coast Guard integrated with the Navy and change whatever laws are necessary. We don't need all these little entities, separate entities. We don't need DHS. That's a huge bureaucratic nightmare and a waste of money. Just my two cents. Anyway, having said all of that, the way to deal with the drug problem decisively is here at home. And as I pointed out many times, what we need to do is we need some laws, new laws that say, if you are caught trafficking in women and children, you know, human trafficking, if you are caught trafficking drugs inside the United States, and then you are tried in a court of law and found guilty, the penalty is death. You have to execute these people. And everybody says, oh, no, we don't want to do that. That's so inhumane. Well, I've got news for you. It may be inhumane, but the damage these people do inside our country is many, many times worse than simply executing them. And everyone I've talked to in law enforcement, whether they're Border Patrol or sheriffs, local police, they all say this thing, oh, if you did that, this whole thing would stop. You know, do you really want to be captured with drugs and children that you're trafficking and then tried in a court of law and knowing that if you're found guilty, which is a very high probability at that stage, that you will be executed? Are you going to continue to do this? The answer is no. So you can't pay people enough money to reckon with almost certain execution. So that we need to do that here. The other thing is, everything here in the United States reaches back into the cartels in Mexico in terms of the drug trafficking and human trafficking. They make more money now from human trafficking, frankly, than they do from the drugs. And these networks move all over the continental United States. We also have a problem down from Canada. That's a separate issue, but it's part of this. But the larger part is, frankly, coming up from Mexico, whether it comes from the sea or it comes overland. If you begin attacking targets inside Mexico without first destroying the networks here inside the United States, then you're going to have war inside the United States while you're trying to wage war against the so-called cartels of Mexico. So there's never been an understanding strategically of what has to come first. You know, what phase has to be number one. We still have over 50 million people in this country that are not here legally, that haven't been born here. We had President Trump who said, I'm going to round them up and send them home. What has happened? Not much. There is no strategy. No strategy. And there has never been an effort from the White House, from the very top, to explain to the American people, this is what it looks like. Here's the map. This is what's being done to us. This is the tragedy inside our country. These are the reasons I am prepared to take these measures now. You know, everyone was very upset over the SAP cuts. We used to talk about food stamps. Now we talk about SAP. And they said, well, this is inhumane. Well, I agree with that. But how many of the people on this program are illegals? I mean, how many people are benefiting from free health care, free food, free housing, free this, free that, who are not even legally in the United States, who came in with this massive influx under Joe Biden? I mean, these things have to be addressed. That's what's really important. That's the life or death of our society, not what's happening down in the Caribbean basin and not what's going on in Eastern Europe or the Middle East.
Right. And the real problem that I have is that this administration, you hit it, that there's no strategy. There's no strategy with anything. It's just actions that are divorced from strategy, which in my view, very often, if not even most of the time, is worse than doing nothing, because you take half measures that just elicit a response, et cetera. Unfortunately, we're not out of the woods, even in the south of our border with Mexico, because now here there is rising evidence that it could be an action against Venezuela coming up. I guess it was just a couple of days ago, Secretary of State Marco Rubio announced that there was basically an ultimatum coming up by the 24th of November. Gary, if you can put that full screen up there. Not that one, the other one, the one from the state. That's the one there. They designated Cartel de las Solas as a foreign terrorist organization. And that's effective on November 24th. Based in Venezuela, the Cartel de las Solas is headed by Nicolas Maduro, we claim, and other high-ranking individuals of the illegitimate Maduro regime who have corrupted Venezuela's military, intelligence, legislature, and judiciary. There is a lot of evidence, Doug, that this is basically saying to Maduro, you will either leave the country voluntarily or we will come get you, and all bets are off on November 24th. That is not lost on the Venezuelan opposition leader, Machado, who she's saying the regime's long and violent abuse of power is ending. A new Venezuela is emerging from the ashes, renewed in spirit and united in purpose, like a phoenix reborn, fierce, radiant, and unstoppable. And I actually was on a Newsmax show this morning where they reported just before I went on that she is also claiming that she feels like that an attack from the United States is imminent, i.e. today is the 18th, the 24th is coming up pretty soon. How do you see this?
Well, I think some of her rhetoric is very reminiscent of what we heard from Guaido. He was her predecessor, the CIA pick to run Venezuela. That particular coup attempt did not work out well. I think somebody dubbed it the Bay of Piglets because it just went nowhere. And there had been other attempts to remove Hugo Chavez and so forth. Machado is saying all the right things in the hopes that she will be installed in power. And I think there's a recognition that if you want fundamental change, what we think is in our interest in Venezuela, that means that you've got to remove the government. The only way to remove the government is to intervene militarily. Now, this potential military operation, what's it called? Operation Spear, Southern Spear?
Southern Spear, I think is what it is, something like that.
I have redesignated that as Operation Southern Self-Sodomization because there's nothing good. Nothing good will come of this. This is an enormous country. It has 30 million people in it. I don't believe the vast majority of people down there are going to rise up in support and cheer us as we intervene in the country to install Machado. I just don't see that happening. And the CIA is pretty good with its color revolutions. It's had some successes, but I don't see that occurring in Venezuela. I see much worse things coming out of it.
And you know, Doug, I'll just add in there, some of the information coming out of Venezuela says that there is not a lot of popular support for her because she's claiming all these things and, you know, the Phoenix Rising and all this kind of stuff. But they said they've heard that a lot before the people, and it never materializes. It exchanges one bad regime for the other. And I don't think a lot of people are very have very high expectations that she's going to be different from that. So even if we install her, I don't know that it's going to be any better unless, and you answer me, tell me what you think of this, is that we're just putting her in there because we want access to all their natural resources, the gold, the oil, and other kinds of capabilities they have, and she'll just be a willing supplicant. What do you think?
Well, no, I think that's the idea. There are people that are trying to figure out if you can get into Venezuela, you can install a friendly government, how you can collateralize the resources down there, the oil, the gas, the gold mines, the emerald mines, the lithium and other rare earths. I mean, the place is loaded with all of these goodies. Now, we know that Ambassador Grinnell did conduct negotiations with the Maduro government. And he came back with what was a very lucrative arrangement that would have given us, let's put it this way, a strong position in the oil and gas industries as well as in the other areas. President Trump, ostensibly under advice from the Secretary of State, Marco Rubio, rejected that. Now I'm told that he may be reconsidering. I don't know. I don't care how embarrassing it may be for him to look foolish after having spent all this money and assembled all these forces to then turn around and say, we'll take the deal. You know, I'm 100% for Shakespeare's famous words, take the deal. We absolutely should take the deal.
Absolutely.
Forget this war down there. It's a waste of time, money, and resources. So I don't know what will happen. It could be another event similar to what happened to the Iranians, where we were talking to them in Qatar, and then bang, all of a sudden, in the midst of the discussions, the Israelis launched their attacks. And we knew that. We knew what was happening. That is why we have no credibility whatsoever in the region anymore, and we don't have much credibility around the world any longer. Nobody believes us. So I hope that's not what's happening right now with regard to Venezuela. But it would be nice if we simply took the deal. Now, let's pause for a second. I don't know. Do you have a map of Venezuela you could put up?
I think I do, actually. Let me pull this up. Gary, if you have anything handy, that's great. If you could pull that up. Yeah, he's got something. Gary's going to pull that up.
Well, if you just pull up the map and show people the coastline and where the Bolivar International Airport is located. That's located very near the coast. That would not be difficult to seize. That could be seized pretty quickly. In fact, you know, 2,000 or 3,000 Marines could easily seize that. Caracas is somewhat inland from that point, and Caracas is a strange place because it sits in a kind of bowl surrounded by mountains, and to get into it, you have to take tunnels through the mountains. And it's very difficult to use the airport in Caracas itself because it has a very short runway. I don't remember how many thousands of feet, but it's certainly not 4,000. I guess what I'm trying to say is, okay, you can take the international airport on the coast. You could probably seize other airfields in the country, but then you've got to get into Caracas. How do you get in there? What if the obvious avenues of approach like these tunnels are blocked? And you have to go up over hills and mountains in order to get into it. Where is all the air and missile defense? How can you be sure that you've gotten most of it before you try to lift any troops? Are you going to fly them in on UH-60s and accompanied by Apache helicopters? Where are you going? What are you going to do? Are you going to fly? I think we are about 17,000 troops now on Puerto Rico. Are you going to fly those troops down there, land them, and then somehow or another transport them, or are you going to parachute them in? You know, parachuting troops is a very, very hazardous operation. You know, there's a reason why nobody does it anymore. The airborne operations of the Second War were universally failures. You just end up with a lot of people on the ground milling around trying to figure out who's where, who's doing what to whom. Then they have to have some sort of firepower, protection. You have to sustain them. I mean, it's a mess. I don't know what the plans are. I don't know what people are thinking. All I'm trying to point out is that this is a much more challenging affair than I think people realize. Because I hear again and again and again from people, oh, well, it's like Panama. Well, look at Panama, then look at Venezuela. Venezuela is the size of France, Germany, Austria, and Switzerland together, roughly. What is Panama? Panama is a pipsqueak place. And we have a much longer historic presence in Panama. We knew all the key actors. It was a much different operation. That's not the case in Venezuela. And again, as I've said before, I worry that this could then become a rallying point that mobilizes people across Latin America against us. And you have a 1,780-mile border with Brazil, a 1,780-mile border roughly with Colombia, and all sorts of paramilitaries and guerrillas and mercs and God knows what else can pour into that country with the single goal of doing harm to us because we have troops on the ground. In other words, there's nothing very clean about this. There's no promise that this will be straightforward or short by any means. So I hope people will reconsider the wisdom of doing this. I just don't see much good coming of it.
I certainly advocate the same thing you said about take the deal. That is the best thing for the United States. And I just hope that President Trump doesn't listen to Secretary of War Pete Hegseth, who seems to me as somebody who relishes his title of Secretary of War and seems really interested in going to use military conflict. I hope he does not get released on this mission especially. But
we still have the Secretary of State, who wields a great deal of power right now. He's the National Security Advisor as well as the Secretary of State.
Yeah, and he definitely seems very interested in actions down around in the South as well. But, hopefully he doesn't, neither one of them gets successful, and we can take the deal that comes up because that would be better for the United States. And if we're really interested in America first, that's the best path to get that. And as always, we really appreciate you coming on and pointing those things out and telling us the real potential pitfalls and consequences of doing things in a different way and the truth that you always provide about what's really going on. Thank you very much for coming on.
Okay. Thank you too, Dan.
And we appreciate you guys. As a reminder, we are on podcast as well. So if you'd like to get your information on the podcast version, go to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Podcast Addict, type in Daniel Davis Deep Dive. You'll find us waiting there for you. We're also on the Substack, on the written format, and DanielDavisDeepDive.substack.com. You can find us waiting there for you too. We have a lot of opportunities there, a lot of different information, ways for you to get the truth, because we are unintimidated and uncompromised to bring you all the truth that you need, and you will get it in whatever form you most like it as well. And speaking of that, we've actually got some more shows coming up for you later this afternoon. Patrick Kennison is going to be back with us later today, and we're also going to be looking at what in the world is going on in Washington, D.C. today with the Epstein file issue. That drama is continuing on, not working out the way that some in the administration wanted, but you're not going to want to miss that. 2 p.m. today, we're going to give you the latest on that, and we will see you then on the Daniel Davis Deep Dive.